tradition says that I come. So, just like now, for example, there's a lot of consciousness about global warming. Fortunately, we in America have a president who's on the cutting edge of environmental consciousness. So the idea is that there is a natural environmental balance, and when that balance is disturbed, it has to be addressed. The balance has to be restored. So there's also a balance to life, not only environmentally, but there's psychological balance, and ultimately there's spiritual balance. If we study our own existence, we can see that we have material bodies. In this case, we have human bodies. And at the same time, we are within the body, we are consciousness. We are conscious. In fact, we speak, it's common to speak in English about going within oneself and so on. So consciousness is a different kind of thing than the physical. And therefore, in philosophy, there's always been a, actually, if you study the history of philosophy, what has always been actually the most important part of it, which is the metaphysical. In Greek, meta means beyond or after, that which is beyond the physical. So, I'm describing a little bit, this is very simple, it's a very simple philosophical concept to get to a point about the appearance of Krishna. For example, consciousness is ultimately metaphysical. We can talk about the nervous system, which is associated with consciousness, but consciousness itself, the experience of actually being aware, cannot be reduced down to a physical object, because the essence of consciousness is not to be an object, but to be a subject. And if we think about it, whatever we know about any material thing, we know about it to the extent that it's an object of consciousness. But the essence of consciousness is not to be an object, but rather to be a subject. It's to be the awareness itself. So, not only consciousness itself is metaphysical, but values, what we call values, are metaphysical. For example, the American political system, one of the great contradictions and one of the fantastic ironies of modern culture is that we live in an age where the bona fide political system is secular democracy, and yet democracy is based on a religious assumption, namely the assumption of equality. If we conduct every conceivable type of empirical test, we will find that people are not equal. So the claim, which is found in the Declaration of Independence in America and other documents and other cultures, the claim that we are equal is actually empirically absurd. It's clearly not a physical claim, it's a metaphysical claim. So interestingly, democracy, our political system, is actually based on a religious claim. And you could talk about justice, for example. There's no physical object you can point to which is a justice. Justice is a value. It's a value placed on what is considered to be quid pro quo, the notion that people get what they deserve, and so on. But the notion that people should get what they deserve, or that people actually deserve something, is itself a metaphysical notion. There's no physical object which demonstrates that people deserve anything. Deserving itself is a value, and the application of deserving, which is called a justice system, is clearly a metaphysical notion. The reason I bring that up is because if we study the history of civilizations, what we find is, whether it's Vedic civilization or whatever, is that we have physical bodies, we have physical needs, such as the need for shelter, food, protection, and people, most people have, to some extent, sexual needs, which are channeled into such institutions as marriage and child raising and so on. So we have these physical needs, but at the same time, if we are not restrained, if we are not moderated by some value system, then we simply degenerate into animalism. Well, that is what happened, isn't it? Well, I guess we're talking about the modern world. Anyway, the idea is that a higher value would be that in all cases, let's say I'm a doctor and I'm treating patients, and if it's the case that I can cheat the patient will die, but I can do it in such a way that I won't be caught and I can make money, because cheating the patient turns out to be, I can make more money than if I actually do the real treatment and I won't get caught. I mean, imagine a situation like that. If people only pursued their brute physical self-interest and they were in no sense restrained or moderated or influenced by notions of justice, of compassion, of kindness, of love, then the world would become quite brutal. So to the extent that there are higher principles, honesty, justice, compassion, and so on, is because people place value on non-physical things. And so there's a natural balance in life between our physical needs and the methods we use to satisfy them and our higher values, our spiritual values, our moral values. Now generally, also if you study the history of civilization, people's moral values tend to come from spiritual notions, some sense of a divine existence, a god, a goddess, some sense that in the universe or beyond the universe there are not merely human beings or other life forms, but there are divine beings, or we ourselves are ultimately divine beings. So now, in terms of the particular historical period we live in, if we take it for granted for the moment that history moves dialectically, if you know your Hegel and Marx and all that, that history moves dialectically, then we are in a historical period in which a previous spiritual consensus, which in Europe or America was Christianity, has basically collapsed. So we live in a secular society, we live in a multicultural society, and there actually is no spiritual consensus. There is no religious or metaphysical consensus, and therefore there is no united or agreed upon set of values which can regulate and restrain animalistic selfishness. And the result is consumerism, the modern world. This is something like what Krishna is talking about. When Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that when Dharma collapses, then I come. Dharma is not simply a Hindu concept or an Indian concept. If it was, it wouldn't be a valid concept. Because if you consider science, science is based on the notion of uniformitarianism. The idea that, for example, if in America there's a law of gravity, and in India or Uganda or on the moon, there must be a similar law of gravity. When Newton put forward his physical principles, he believed he was describing forces that operate uniformly throughout the universe, not simply in England in the 17th century. So in the same way, just as a scientific principle to be valid has to be universally valid, in the same way, a moral principle or a spiritual principle to be ultimately valid has to be universally valid. Otherwise, we're not talking about metaphysics, we're simply talking about psychology, as in the statement that, oh, is that true for you? Is that your God? Is that what you believe? Does that make you feel good about yourself? So there's this modern notion that theology, philosophy, can all be reduced down to psychology, that a particular claim about the universe or God is true if it has a beneficial psychological effect. And so this is, I mean, I don't want to go into this too much, but to make a long story short, ultimately absurd. Philosophy cannot be reduced down to psychology. Some things make us feel good, but are actually terribly wrong and destructive. So Dharma, the notion of Dharma, I'll talk about that because Krishna says that he comes when Dharma collapses. The Sanskrit word Dharma comes from a surprise Sanskrit root, because Sanskrit is an organic language in the sense that all of the different parts of speech, such as, all the different parts of speech, I'll assume you know what that means, they actually are traced to verbal roots. The idea is that the world is a world of motion. Even if you take verbs like to be is an activity. To exist is an activity. It's doing something. It's an action. There is no absolutely passive state, because even existence, grammatically and actually, is doing something. It's existing, as opposed to not existing. So anyway, in Sanskrit, the word dharma is traced to the root dhar. That's how to pronounce it. Which means to sustain or to hold. And so dharma, if you look at older Sanskrit, not the Mahabharata or Bhagavad Gita or even Bhagavatam, but if you look at the Vedas, if you look at older Sanskrit, you find that the word dharma means an essential quality, that which sustains the identity of a thing. Like, for example, as Prabhupada said, liquidity. Liquidity is the dharma of fire, water, because liquidity sustains the identity of water. Or heat is, in a sense, the dharma of fire, and so on. So in that sense, our dharma as a duty, as a sacred duty, it's that which sustains our identity. Wow. That wasn't me. It's obviously an alien attack. As prophesied. So, the idea is, for example, in Sanskrit, you can talk about Raja Dharma, which means literally Raja, royal, the Dharma of kings. So, Raja Dharma, the duties of kings, means that if you behave in a certain way, you're actually a king. And even though you may have a title, if you don't behave in a proper way, you're not a real king. It's just like, for example, someone may have a certificate like, I'm a medical doctor. But if they chronically malpractice, we could say to them, you're not a real doctor. Or you're a charlatan, you're a fake or a phony or whatever. So the dharma of something is that which makes that thing what it really is. So ultimately, there is a Sanatan Dharma, an eternal dharma, which sustains or defines us as eternal beings. Maybe you could deal with this. You need to deal with this. So, what Krishna says is that I come whenever dharma is collapsing. In other words, who are we? Why do we exist? What is our duty? What are appropriate relationships between people? What is an appropriate relationship between human beings and nature? What is our ultimate self-interest? All these things are regulated by dharma. Dharma enlightens us and shows us how we can be who we really are, how we can understand ourselves and achieve the perfection of life. So, for example, if law and order break down in a particular city or neighborhood, a good government should rectify it. This is what Krishna is talking about. Krishna or God creates the universe, and when the system is breaking down somewhere, Krishna comes and fixes it. So Krishna and Dharma, these are not sectarian ideas. The very word Krishna means all attractive. God is all attractive. If you know Vedanta, Vedanta begins with the statement, Janmadhyasya Jataha, that the Absolute or God is the source of everything. So, there's an interesting argument given by Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which Prabhupada translated as Nectar Devotion. Interestingly, a great medieval Christian philosopher, Anselm, gave a very, basically the same argument. And the argument is basically this, which you find in the Nectar Devotion and also in Anselm as the ontological proof of God's existence, that because God is infinitely great, therefore the highest description of God is the truest. That description of God, which most expansively or to the greatest degree glorifies God, is actually closest to the truth. I mean, that is a very interesting argument, but for now, anyway, if we go with this for now, then if we take all the virtues of this world, we take all those qualities of the world which we find attractive, to which we give positive value, like beauty, justice, wisdom, strength, and so on, then Krishna or God possesses these infinitely. Krishna possesses infinite strength, infinite wisdom, infinite beauty, and so on. God is infinitely beautiful. So the idea of Krishna, it's not a sectarian idea. It's not simply a dogmatic idea. It's not like the irrational claim we find in certain religions that this is the only Son of God. This claim is irrational not only because it's like, if we're not sons of God, who are we? Or daughters, sons or daughters. But anyway, I don't want to deconstruct dogmatic Christianity right now because it's, first of all, it's too easy, and second of all, it's... But anyway, suffice it to say that if you make a claim that this is the highest truth, that truth should, on the face of it, it should be rationally true. Otherwise, it's a dogmatic, irrational claim. For example, to make the claim that all of us are sinners and therefore we all deserve to die, and therefore in order to save us, God had to come and kill himself, is not actually true. Because if God is all powerful, God can pardon anyone he likes. He can just say, okay, you're exonerated, now stop being an idiot. God can actually do this. So to make the claim, for example, my parents never tortured themselves for me. The idea that God showed his love by coming and undergoing all kinds of horrible pain. I don't think I would have, if my parents would have started mutilating themselves or torturing themselves in some way to show me they loved me, I think I would have probably called 911 and tried to get them serious psychiatric attention. The idea that parents don't, in order to demonstrate they really love their children, they have to torture themselves or mutilate themselves, I think it's just grossly irrational. It's just grossly irrational. Or if I say this is the only way in a particular religion. I mean, first of all, that irrational claim is based on another irrational claim, which is that God really should kill all of us because we're all imperfect. So that if I have a child and my child's imperfect, I should kill it. Or if I make the claim that this is the only way. If I say that this is the only true religion, there should be something objectively, not dogmatically, not something you merely have to believe on faith, but there should be something intrinsically, objectively superior, either philosophically or ethically, there should be something intrinsically superior about that particular path. And when we're left to say that, well, there's nothing intrinsically superior here, it's just something you have to believe, we have an irrational claim. Now, the world is full of so many dogmatic, irrational religious claims. We can look at the Bhagavad Gita and say, is this another dogmatic claim? Or is what Krishna is saying objectively reasonable? And if you study the Bhagavad Gita, you'll find it is. I mean, I haven't got so much time now because I want to finish before I'm dragged off. But if you read Bhagavad Gita and you try to understand what Krishna is saying, the Bhagavad Gita is not a dogmatic work. It's not an irrational work. In fact, according to the Bhagavad Gita, if you connect the dots in the Bhagavad Gita, what you'll find is, that according to Krishna, you can be happy in this world and you can even be elevated in the universe without Krishna. Because Krishna says Krishna doesn't have self-esteem problems like the gods of some religions. He's not jealous. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Urdvanga Chanti Sattvasta. Literally, those who stand in goodness, Sattvasta, Urdvanga Chanti, they go up. And Krishna says, Sattat Sanjayate Sukham. From goodness comes happiness. From goodness comes knowledge. And yet in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also says that yajante sattvika devan. Those in goodness worship the gods, in the plural, not Krishna. Now we're talking about the material mode of goodness, but the idea here is that the basic criteria, the qualification for being elevated in this world is not dogmatic, it's not ideological, it's ethical. So that as you become a good person, a virtuous person, a moral person, you're elevated. Not by believing a particular religious doctrine, but by the ethical quality of your behavior. And ultimately, knowing Krishna, you get Krishna by loving Krishna, because otherwise, unless Krishna said that only those who love me can know me, Krishna would be violating the most natural law in the universe, which is the law of reciprocity. Even we ourselves reciprocate with people. We love those who love us, or we are intimate with those who somehow earned our intimacy. So if you study the whole Bhagavad Gita, whether it talks about people's fate in this world or the principles of higher devotion, it's actually all reasonable. It's not dogmatic. And ultimately leads to the highest truth in Krishna. Krishna comes to this world. Well, I've explained that. I won't repeat myself here. Anyway, this is sort of the shotgun approach here tonight. But I wanted to throw out some points for your consideration. There's a lot to say about Krishna. We can speak about Krishna eternally and never really exhaust the subject. But these are some points that just occurred to me to mention here on the anniversary of Krishna's appearance in this world. So, any questions on these points? About Krishna, about Krishna's appearance. Very good, no questions? Yes, you know better than to unleash me again. So, thank you all very much for coming. I think we'll stop here and we'll chant Hare Krishna and so on. Hare Krishna.